Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome to the last Strong Gravity seminar before the holiday. So it's a great pleasure to have Leah Jenks giving the talk today. Leah is a graduate student from Brown University. She will talk about aspects of rotating black holes in dynamical transiamine gravity. Please take it away.
All right. Thank you so much for that introduction. Also, just a quick disclaimer, I've lost my voice a little bit. So if you're having a hard time hearing me, just please feel free to interrupt and I'll try to project a little bit louder. But I'm very excited to be here today to tell you all about some of my recent and ongoing work about black holes in DCS gravity. So this talk is going to be based on two papers, one of which we put out earlier this year in PRD, and one of which the paper is done, but we're just waiting until after the holidays to put out. So it will be out on the archive in January. And this is a collaboration between my advisor, Stefan Alexander at Brown, who, by the way, says hello to everybody, with Greg Gavadazzi at NYU and Nico Yunez at the University of Illinois. All phenomenal collaborators in this. So just to start with, the main takeaways from this talk are threefold. So I'm going to be discussing dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, which I will refer to as DCS, shorthand. And I hope to show you that it's a well-motivated theory with promising cosmological and gravitational implications. And then I'll talk specifically about two aspects of DCS black holes. So the first is the DCS caps, which are these unique geometric structures which DCS black holes have, which can provide some potential novel insights into deviations from GR, ideally potentially in an observational setting. And then I'll also talk about the superradiance process that's induced by rotating black holes in DCS, and again show that there are deviations from GR and some potential observable consequences. So to take a step back for a second and think about the big picture and kind of, you know, why do we care about this anyways, I think about this research at the intersection of two different areas. So on the one hand, we have modified gravity. And so by modified gravity, I don't mean MOND necessarily. I'm referring specifically to well-motivated theories from perhaps beyond the standard model or string theory perspectives, which are corrections or deviations from GR in some way that have, you know, some potential predicted observables. And then on the other hand, we have gravitational observables. And so we are now living in this very exciting time where we have access to gravitational wave data, neutron star data, and black hole images themselves that give us a window into gravity that we didn't have before. And so now, in the same way that particle physicists use colliders at the LHC to look for signatures of physics beyond the standard model, we can use these gravitational observables to look for physics beyond GR. And so that intersection is here, where we want to use these gravitational observables to look for both constraints of modified gravity and signatures as well. And so here I've just highlighted a few other papers that I've done with wonderful collaborators, Joao Magejo, Kent Yagi, and others, not on DCS, but on other types of these well-motivated modified gravity theories where we point towards constraints and signatures of them. So obviously, many other people have also worked in this area. There's a big business, and it's an exciting time to be doing it. So before I get into the technical details here, I want to take a minute to just distill down the essential physics that we're going to be talking about. So the DCS caps, as I mentioned, are these geometric structures, which DCS black holes possess that are induced by the Chern-Simons pseudoscalar accompanying the black hole. And I'll talk about that more in a minute, but the key thing to note is that the DCS scalar is minimized at the equator and maximized at the poles. And the Chern-Simons caps geometrically follow the same type of behavior, the same type of profile. And so we can think about it as, again, this is not a perfect analogy, but a nice kind of physical comparison as an analogy to angular momentum, where if you start with your arms out and then bring them in, as your arms come in, you spin faster. In the same way as the Chern-Simons scalar profile increases, it increases the magnitude of the caps as well. So on the other hand, we have superradiance, and I'm sure I don't need to explain superradiance to anybody here in this audience, but I like to think about it as an analogy to a driven resonance in a harmonic oscillator, where we have the scalar field that is oscillating at some frequency that leads to an instability. Okay, so now I'd like to turn to DCS gravity. So DCS gravity is characterized by the addition of the Chern-Simons term to the Einstein-Hilbert action. And this term arises in many different areas of physics, in particular in string theory and effective field theory. So for example, the Green-Schwarz mechanism in string theory, as well as this effective field theory of inflation, which was a really nice paper by Weinberg, where this term arises. So one nice thing about DCS is that it intrinsically includes an axion-like particle. Excuse me. And this is attractive from a dark matter perspective. And then there are also general perspectives from cosmology, gravitational, and particle physics implications. Excuse me. So when we get into the action of DCS, we have the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is characterized by the addition of this Chern-Simons term here. So we have alpha, which is a coupling constant. This theta is the Chern-Simons pseudoscalar, an axion-like particle. And then this is coupled to the Pontryagin density of the spacetime. And then we also have a kinetic term here for the scalar. So this leads to a modification of the Einstein equations. So we have the Einstein tensor, the energy momentum tensor of the spacetime here, and then this addition of a C tensor term. And so the C tensor term arises from varying the action, the Chern-Simons correction to the action with respect to the metric. So it's directly arising from this term. And we can think about it as a four-dimensional realization of the three-dimensional Cotton tensor in that type of way. And physically, we can think about it as a correction to the effective energy momentum tensor of the spacetime. So if we vary the action with respect to the scalar, we also find that there's an equation of motion for the pseudoscalar field that just looks like a wave equation that is sourced by the Pontryagin density of the spacetime. And so what we'll notice here is that if the Pontryagin of the spacetime is zero, then the scalar field won't have a source, and that will also be zero. So in the case of spacetimes where Pontryagin is zero, such as Schwarzschild, and we have high amounts of spherical symmetry, this scalar is zero, and this whole thing actually reduces back down to GR. So I want to take a minute to also speak a little bit about DCS as an effective field theory, as I mentioned before. So we can write the DCS action in a slightly different way, where again, we have the Einstein-Hilbert, and I have now written the scalar field theta as, as sigma, and then written the coupling alpha as 1/μ to just see this in terms of the mass scale of the theory in a little bit more explicit way. And so we're treating this as an effective field theory, right? So in principle, we have an infinite sum of higher dimensional terms. So one might worry about the validity of this theory and keeping, this higher order derivative term. But What we do is we consider this infinite sum of higher terms. We truncate the series at the first term. And what this does, this allows us to treat this as an effective field theory. We're not treating it as an exact theory, and we never actually reach the scale where DCS breaks down or that we have to worry about ghosts or anything like that. So at the level that we're considering, this is always a valid approximation. And you might be wondering about the scale of mu. And so from the effective field theory perspective, as long as mu is much less than the Planck scale, this is valid. And on the lower bound, there are constraints from observations, but they are very, very loose. They're not stringent at all. So there's really a very wide range of valid parameter space for this coupling parameter.
Leah?
Yes.
So how do we know we can do that? I mean, we can do it at the level of setting initial conditions, but then the evolution can take us away from anything remotely so supporting these assumptions. So how do we know that?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
So with respect to the truncation, you say, well, we can truncate and and we can assume that everything is going to be fine, but we can't, right? It will depend on whatever initial data I'm considering and what that initial data will evolve towards the future. So how can we justify going forward if we don't know that this is going to be sustained?
Right. So that's a great question. So at the level that we are looking at, this is a valid kind of, not necessarily a toy model, but this is a reasonable approximation. So if we were to explicitly go to, you know, much higher energies, one would have to worry about including other terms in the validity of the effective field theory. But you're right, we are making these assumptions that we're in this regime where this is valid.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, great. Okay. So, as I mentioned previously, when we have a space-time with high amounts of symmetry, such as Schwarzschild, DCS just reduces back down to GR. So in order to get a unique DCS solution, one has to go to a rotating space-time. And so this first independent solution in DCS was first found in a slowly rotating approximation by Yunes and Pretorius in 2009. And then this was followed up by other groups to extend to higher orders in the perturbation. So the metric is here as follows, where DSK is just the Kerr metric, just the usual. And then here, zeta is a coupling constant, which is proportional to alpha, so the Chern-Simons coupling. And then chi is the dimensionless spin parameter. And so here we just have this leading order correction, which goes like order zeta chi. This has been extended by these other groups up to order zeta chi to the fourth. But for the sake of not having eight slides to show you this, I'm just showing the leading order term here. But there are corrections to all other components of the metric at higher orders in the spin. So the solution also has a non-trivial scalar field profile, which you'll notice is proportional to a cosine theta, which will be relevant for the DCS caps. The solution also has deviations from Kerr in the locations of the event horizon and the ergosphere. So we see that there are these small corrections that appear at order zeta chi squared in both of these quantities, and this will become important later. Okay, so now this brings us to the Chern-Simons caps. So here I'm writing down the Einstein equations in a slightly different way. So I've written them in trace reversed form, where T bar AB is just the trace reversed energy momentum tensor. And I've moved the C tensor term onto the right-hand side. So I have done that because now this right-hand side of the equation is not necessarily going to be positive definite. There is explicitly a minus sign here. And the reason that we care about that is because of the geodesic focusing theorem. So you can recall, so the geodesic focusing theorem, if we take the Ricci tensor and we contract it with two either null or time-like vectors, these UA, UB, and if that quantity is greater than zero, then if we have a congruence of geodesics, they are always going to focus or converge to a point. And this is interesting because in GR, assuming that the strong or null energy conditions are always satisfied, this statement is always true. And so there's never any violation of this in GR, again, assuming the energy conditions are satisfied. But now we explicitly have this minus sign on the right-hand side. There's no reason, you know, why this term necessarily has to be small. And so it's no longer so clear that this holds. And this is, of course, a cornerstone of the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorem and many other results in GR. And so DCS gravity naturally has this structure where we can potentially have this violation of the focusing theorem. And so I do want to end. Yes.
Sorry, you pointed to the minus sign. Is that because you know the CAB is going to be a positive contribution? I mean, because in principle, also the CAB, I mean, could have any sign.
Correct. Yeah. So it's not necessarily going to be positive. This is just very generically at the level of the equations of motion. And it's right. So you're right. It could be negative. This all could still be positive, but there's no a priori reason why that has to be the case. So this is just showing that there is this potential for this quantity to be negative.
But the potential would have been also there if you have had a plus sign there. That's all I'm saying.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, you can just see it a little bit more explicitly with the minus. yes, so this is a natural feature of DCS gravity that we have this additional contribution to this contraction that could potentially lead to some violation of the focusing theorem. So we can now look at that explicitly. So if we consider a stationary time-like observer in that slowly rotating DCS space-time that I mentioned previously, and we consider this contraction, we find the following. So, here, just some shorthand, F is just the Schwarzschild factor, gamma is just M over R, and C theta is cosine theta. And you'll see that this is all positive definite up to this last term here, where we indeed have a minus sign. And then there's a similar expression at order zeta chi to the fourth, which I'm just not including for sake of space on the slide, but is also present. So if we now look at this geometrically, we find the emergence of the Chern-Simons caps. So here on the left side, this is considering the black hole at theta equals zero, so at the north pole of the black hole. And this is both third and fifth order in the spin. And here on the y-axis, we have the contraction and then R over M here on X. And so we see that from the black hole horizon out to about R is 2.05 or 2.06 M, we do actually have this violation where we have this region of negativity. And so if we extend that to all angles, we find what's over here on the right, where this blue region is the parameter space in theta and R, where this quantity is actually negative. So where we do have this violation of the focusing theorem. So we see that it is peaked at theta equals zero, again, going about to R is about 2.06 M, and then it falls off to about 20 degrees on either side. So these are two regions at the north and the south pole of the black hole, kind of like little caps, which is why we called them Chern-Simons caps. So this was for time-like geodesics. One can also ask if the same thing applies for null geodesics. And the answer is that it does. So we specifically looked at radial null geodesics because this kind of makes the most intuitive sense when we're thinking about ingoing or outgoing congruences. And so similarly, we calculate this contraction. And we find a similar looking expression. Everything is positive definite up until this minus sign. And we find the following here again. So down here we have again at theta equals zero. And so we'll see here that this is actually a much smaller effect for the null geodesics. This is only present when we go to higher order in the spin, that we have this small region of negativity here going only from the horizon out to about R is 2m. So very, very small. And we can see this again when we look at the angular distribution. We can see that it's again maximized at theta equals zero, and then falls off to about 20 degrees on either side. So the time-like effect is definitely stronger, but this is still present here. And this is present for the other null geodesics as well. So in thinking about some implications for this, the main one to think about is that the energy condition of the effective energy momentum tensor is different than what one would expect in GR. So normally, right, we just assume that the energy conditions, strong or null energy conditions, are obeyed. Now it's a little bit different, and we kind of have this unique equation of state, one can think about it, in the caps. And so we're interested in thinking about how the presence of these caps might impact the behavior of matter close to these black holes. And so just to give you some physical intuition for the size of these caps, if we consider the black hole at the center of the M87 galaxy, which has a mass of about 6.5 billion solar masses, for the time-like geodesics, that maximum extent of 2.06 m for R is going to be about 3 astronomical units. And 3 AU is about the scale from the sun to the asteroid belt. So kind of inner solar system sized regions are the areas that we're talking about. And of course, compared to the scale of the black hole, this is quite small, but they still have the potential to give us some unique signatures of DCS. So with that in mind, that has motivated us to look at super radiance in DCS. And so, and to see if the presence of these caps would impact the super radiance process for these black holes. And so to spoil the punchline a little bit, the answer is actually no, that the caps don't impact the super radiance process. However, looking at super radiance in DCS has proven to show some deviations from GR and is a promising direction to look at in its own right. So, as I mentioned previously, super radiance is a process in which we have a scalar field that is amplified by the rotation of a black hole, giving rise to a black hole bomb effect, as was originally coined by Preston Tucholsky in the 70s. And there has been much work done on this process by many people, very notably, of course, the string axiverse by Asmina Arvanitaki and collaborators in 2009, looking at potential ways to astrophysically detect the super radiance process. This has also been extended to ultralight vectors by these authors, as well as tensor modes. And so generally, super radiance, if we have some ultralight field and the rotation of the black hole, the traditional way that we think about it is giving rise to these two axion clouds emanating from the black hole in a sort of gravitational atom analogy. So before I get into super radiance in DCS, I want to just take a minute to review the analogous process in GR. So we're going to consider a massive scalar field on a Kerr black hole background. So that just amounts to solving the Klein-Gordon equation on a Kerr background. Here, box K is just D'Alembertian on the Kerr background. Mu is the mass of the scalar. And then phi is just the scalar field itself. And there are many people who have solved this previously. We are going to follow the methods of Steven Detweiler from his original paper in 1980. So looking at the low frequency and low mass limit of the field. So omega m is small and mu m is small. So in order to do this analytically, we do need to consider this particular limit, one of these particular limits for the field. It is possible to do this exactly, and that's been done numerically, of course, but we wanted to focus on an analytical solution, which is why we're taking this limit. And so when we do this, the Klein-Gordon equation separates really nicely, and we can make the following ansatz for the field. So here, this SL theta is just going to be a Legendre polynomial PLM in GR, and then this RL is going to have some complicated radial dependence. So going through many technical details, which I'm going to skip, which you can find in the paper, one finds that the frequency spectrum that is maximized here is for the L equals one and M equals one mode of the field. And that corresponds to an imaginary component of the frequency that is proportional to this mu M to the eighth. So you'll see here in this.
Yeah, moment, I see. Shami has a question.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, sorry, maybe I missed, but what is your N here? So you have L equals one, M equals one. What is your N?
Yeah, so those are just the like Legendre polynomial PLMs, the angular azimuthal number.
Yeah, I mean, but your modes are determined by N, L, M, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quantum numbers. What is your N?
Oh, sorry, N is zero in this case.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions?
So Luis, your hand is raised. Still have a question?
No, sorry, that was the leftover.
Okay. Great. Yes, so as we can see, the super radiance is going to be determined by the imaginary contribution to the frequency here, which causes this contribution to exponentially grow. And so what we find is that the imaginary contribution to the frequency is proportional to this mu m to the eighth. This is this standard GR result. So now we can turn to super radiance in DCS. So we're going to consider DCS gravity plus a scalar field. So the full theory that we're going to consider is the first three terms in this action here, which are just the vacuum DCX action that I showed before, as well as an additional scalar, which has the following action here. And so I want to emphasize here that we're not actually considering super radiance of the DCS scalar. We're considering a DCS black hole plus the DCS scalar plus an additional scalar, which is super radiating. So this is the setup for our study. So in doing this, we again are going to take that slowly rotating DCS solution up to order zeta chi squared in the rotation. So the Klein-Gordon equation now becomes, we have a Kerr contribution to the Dillon-Barishin. We have a DCS contribution, which comes from the DCS contribution to the metric. And then we have our mass and then our scalar field. So in order to solve this, we're going to consider this perturbatively in phi. So we're going to consider that phi is some background, which some background field plus some perturbation that is induced by the DCS contribution. And so making that same Detweiler ansatz, we can make that same Detweiler assumption here, the limit, we can make the following ansatz. So we're going to consider our phi LM. This is, of course, going to be a sum over all L's and M's, but this is just the shorthand. And we're going to have the background solution here, which is just proportional to a PLM, the Legendre P, and then this background radial term, which is not necessarily the GR term, but we're just going to call this the background term. And then we have from the explicit DCS contributions, we have actually three contributions. So for every L, we have a PLM, we have a PL plus two, and then we have a PL minus two. So there's this really nice pattern that emerges that with these DCS corrections, we actually have three corrections to the scalar field profile for every L. And so there are, again, many technical details here, which I'm going to for the sake of time skip, and you can find them in our paper, but there are a few things that I do want to highlight, some interesting aspects of this calculation. And so the first is asymptotic matching. So in order to solve the Klein-Gordon equation and find the relevant frequencies where this field exhibits the superradiant behavior, we perform a procedure of matched asymptotic extensions. And so in doing that, we consider three regions. So we have this little cartoon here. This is not necessarily to scale or, you know, geometrically representative. This is just an intuitive cartoon to show a schematic of the system. So here, this is the black hole in the center. And then we're going to consider three zones. So we're going to consider the far zone, which is this blue region here. And that's characterized where R is much larger than M. We're going to consider a near zone where R, the difference between R and the horizon is much less than L over omega or L over mu. And then we're going to consider a intermediate buffer zone where both of those approximations are actually true. And we can always find a zone where this is valid. And so what we do is we solve the Klein-Gordon equation in the far zone. We've solved the Klein-Gordon equation in the near zone. And then we take each of those solutions, expand them in the opposite limit, and then demand that those two re-expanded solutions must be asymptotic to each other in order to find the frequencies. So this is the kind of standard procedure that is followed in GR as well, and that we follow to perform this calculation. So another interesting technical detail, which is not present in the GR calculation, is this need to perform a near zone metric resummation. So one thing you may have noticed when I flashed up the DCS metric earlier, is that the DCS metric has spurious divergences at the Schwarzschild and Kerr horizons. So the way that we normally write it, we have factors of R minus 2M and factors that are zero at the Kerr horizon as well. And this is normally fine if we're far away from the black hole, which usually we are, because far away, the fact that the Kerr horizon, that the DCS horizon is shifted from the Kerr horizon is not a problem because it's such a small contribution. However, when we're in this near zone and we're actually wanting to be close to the black hole, we have to be a little bit careful. And so we need to account for the fact that the location of the horizon is actually different from Kerr. And so we do that by performing this metric resummation. And so there are, in principle, an infinite number of ways in which to do this. But the two points that need to be satisfied are first that the resummed metric identically reduces to the original metric when we expand in small spin. So when we expand out the metric, we get the usual one back. And then secondly, that each component has to remain finite outside the DCS horizon. So this is basically just saying we want to avoid any of these divergences at Schwarzschild or Kerr. And so the way that we have chosen to do this is by resumming the quantity delta. So delta appears in the Kerr metric and is characterized by being zero when evaluated at the Kerr horizon. So we now define this new quantity delta bar such that delta bar evaluated at the DCS horizon is zero. And so in doing this, in order to make sure that the first point is satisfied, when we explicitly expand out in the spin, we have to add counter terms to our metric to essentially cancel out these extra contributions. And so what we find is that at this particular second order in the spin, there are two counter terms in the RR component and in the TT component that we have to add to the full metric in order to satisfy this. So there are counter terms to all of the other components of the metric as well, except for the theta term, but those enter at higher orders in the spin. So we're not going to worry about them here. We just need to focus on these two. And so we find that the full resummed metric components that we consider are the Kerr metric with delta goes to delta bar, the DCS contribution with the Schwarzschild factor goes to delta bar over R squared, plus the counter turns. And then the other components remain the same. So again, going through many technical details, we find the frequency spectrum for the DCS contributions. So recall that we have the L plus two and L minus two contributions in the DCS overall contribution to the scalar. And so we find that the L and L plus two corrections are both maximized for L equals one and M equals one. This is all also at N equals zero. And so for L equals one, omega L again has this characteristic frequency that goes like mu M to the eighth over 24. L plus two for L equals one goes like mu M to the 16th. So this is very highly suppressed. And then the L minus two mode is maximized for L equals three and M equals one. And so this L equals three maximum frequency is going to have the same characteristic frequency for the L equals one L mode that we can see here. So to look at that graphically, here I'm just showing the frequency spectrum. So here we have L equals one and L equals three. So the solid line is the L equals L, the dot dashed line is L plus two, and then the dotted line is L minus two. And so as I showed in equation form on the last slide, we can see that this is highly dominated by this L equals one, the PLM contribution. These curves and these curves are the same. And then you see that it's highly, highly suppressed once we increase the L's. And this is what we would expect in line with the GR contribution, with the GR solution that we know. So even though we know these contributions are small, it's of interest to think about the angular dependence of the black hole to see if of the scalar field to see if there are any modifications that might be observable. So if we look at the angular profile of the scalar cloud, remember that in the GR case, we just have these two emanating lobes. And so here, this is showing the background solution and the DCS contributions. And so for L equals one and L equals three. So we see that this whole thing is highly dominated by the L equals one GR case. And this is what we would expect because again, we're treating this perturbatively. So we don't want the DCS contributions to be taking over. So we see that the DCS contributions here, this is the sum of all three of those L, L plus two and L minus two modes are pretty highly suppressed, but are still additive onto the scalar field. And then when we look at the L equals three, we see that the GR is suppressed and the DCS is still suppressed compared to the GR, but enhanced a little bit because we have that L minus two contribution. And so again, there is going to be in principle an infinite sum over all of the L's, but we've shown that L equals one and L equals three are the dominant ones. So those are the specific modes that I'm focusing on here. So overall, these are small corrections, but they are corrections nonetheless. So we can also think about the time evolution of the field. So here I'm showing, again, just the background solution and then the perturbation and the evolution. And the perturbation, this delta phi, is what contains all three of the L, L plus two, and L minus two modes. And so again, we see that the L equals one background solution is the most dominant here, and the perturbation is subdominant. And there will be a time where these two become equivalent, but that time is much greater than, for example, a Hubble time. So we you know, the validity of our theory is not, you know, valid when we get to that point. So at this point, everything is still kind of within the regime of validity. And then again, for L equals three, we see similarly, there will be a time where the DCS contribution takes over because of that L minus two contribution. However, if we do add all of these terms together in a series, it is mostly dominated by this L equals one background part, as we would expect. Okay, so now I'd just like to take a few minutes to talk about the potential observable consequences and some directions for future work, which we're thinking about. So in terms of observables, there are several ways in which one can probe super radiance with black holes. So the first is the black hole spin down and looking at the Reggie plane constraints. So if we have a black hole with this axion cloud, as the axion cloud is oscillating and getting amplified, it takes energy from the black hole that causes it to spin down. So one can construct the parameter space of black hole mass and spin, and making some assumptions about the ages of the black holes and things like that. One can place constraints on the potential mass of the scalar by looking at gaps in this plane. And so this type of analysis has of course been done to constrain the mass of the scalars, but one can imagine adding kind of a third plane in the parameter space and use it to also constrain the DCS coupling. So as I mentioned previously, the DCS coupling is very unconstrained via observations. The most stringent constraint comes from X-ray binaries, I believe. And so if this would be an avenue to give us a more stringent constraint on DCS parameter with this Reggie plane, that's something that would be very promising. One can also look at the gravitational wave emission from the cloud, as of course has been done previously for vector and scalar clouds. And one would imagine that there would be corrections to the gravitational waves due to the fact that we're now in DCS gravity. So that would potentially have some characteristic shift in the phase, for example, one can imagine, and would potentially as well give us some deviations from GR. And then lastly, one can think about using event horizon telescope observations and looking at corrections to, for example, the black hole shadow and seeing how having this DCS black hole with an axion cloud, there would be some shift in what one would expect for the shadow compared to in GR. And of course, this is just GR, the Event Horizon Telescope observation, which could potentially lead to a vast playground to look for DCS. So another potential direction that we're thinking about is fermions. So, and how fermions might play into this whole story. So fermions do not super radiate in GR. This was first proven by Unruh in the 70s for massless fermions and then has been extended by others to show that this is not the case for any fermions. They don't exhibit super radiance around black holes. And so our initial thought was that potentially having the presence of the caps and the additional interactions with the DCS scalar could maybe evade this to obtain fermionic superradiance in DCS, which would of course be a huge smoking gun for DCS if it could be observed. This is unfortunately unlikely just because the reasons that fermions don't superradiate in GR, fermions like to be in bound states, you know, we have the exclusion principle, this still applies in DCS. So this point is unlikely. However, there are some potentially exciting and promising directions forward having to do with a type of induced super radiance with fermions. So one thing that we're thinking about is an analogy to fermionic preheating. So in the same way that we have fermionic preheating after inflation that gives rise to a resonant amplitude of fermions. One could imagine the same process happening here if we have a oscillating scalar around a black hole. Another potential direction that we're thinking about is there's a really nice paper from a couple of years ago by Helvi Vitek and her collaborators, where they showed that you can get induced superradiance in an electromagnetic field from a superradiant scalar in a black hole. So we're thinking about how to potentially extend that to fermions if there's anything promising there. So with that, I would just like to summarize and conclude. So I've discussed DCS gravity and shown several different ways in which it can provide a background to search for observations of modified gravity and some ways that we might start thinking about doing that. I've specifically talked about the DCS caps, which can potentially provide a window into observable signatures. I've also talked about the superradiance process in DCS gravity and shown that it is distinct from GR and leads to small corrections in these scalar field profiles that could be probed via the traditional superradiance observable studies. And of course, as always, much more work is necessary. And I think there are many promising directions to go from here. And with that, I thank you so much for your time and attention. And I'm very happy to take any other questions.
Thank you, Leah, for the very nice talk. So questions? Yeah, Will.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for the nice talk. So one question I had is, so your conclusion was the effect of the black hole being a term Simon's black hole as opposed to GR one on superradiance was very small. So I wanted to understand to what degree that was just because the extra term Simon effects don't affect superradiance that much, or it's just basically the regime that you were put in by the approximation scheme you were made, like in particular, you're assuming low spin and kind of a non-relativistic cloud that kind of sits far away from the black hole, so therefore might not feel kind of the near horizon differences between term Simons and GR that much.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So I think there's two kind of specific, two distinct questions here. So first is the presence of the DCS caps, which we were hoping would lead to some unique type of behavior. And so we were a little bit puzzled that those didn't seem to come into play at all. But our hypothesis is that the DCS caps, as I showed, are maximized at the north and south pole of the black hole and are essentially zero at the equator, whereas superradiance is a process, right, which is driven by this rotation, which is maximized at the equator. And so the two kind of regimes where they're appearing are just not overlapping. So that's what we kind of posit about that. And then in terms of being limited by the DCS solution, that is certainly a possibility. So, right. So as you said, we're considering this low frequency, low mass. Of course, the solution that we have is only for low spin. So if one were to solve this numerically and do full numerical relativity, I think it is quite possible that if one allowed those parameters to vary more, there would be a bigger effect. I think it would still be small. It would still be subdominant to the GR, but I think it would be a bigger effect than the one that we're showing.
So remind me, are there perturbative solutions for Chern-Simon black holes around extremality that you could potentially use for this?
Yes. So I believe there is an extremal solution. I think that was Nico Yunez and collaborators as well have found that. So that could be something that would be interesting to look at as well.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think Leo Stan worked on that.
Yes, yeah.
Luis?
Thank you, Leah. So it's a related question. So you find that superradiant is affected. So let's imagine that if you were able to do this without all the assumptions that you were just discussing, suppose there is a robust effect where you're going to grow not your toy scalar field that is there just to kind of probe what's going on, but the dilaton or whatever the scatter field of this here is. So as opposed to the standard super radiance mechanism where the scatter field is minimally coupled to the metric gate, here you have something that's intricately coupled with the metric. Mm-hmm. So following this line, if you now see a scatter field that grows, and it is the growth, it is the scatter field of the theory, would you not be worried that a potential instability might destroy your black hole? I mean, we don't know the stabilities of this black hole. So maybe would that be a worry? That's what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So I believe that a stability analysis has been done for the solution to show that it is stable to perturbations. But in terms of thinking about coupling the Chern-Simon scalar and having some super radiance. So we didn't consider that because the Chern-Simon scalar one usually just takes to be massless. And so even if it were to be super radiant, it's going to be a much, much smaller effect. So I don't think one would necessarily need to worry about that, but that's a good question.
Thanks. So the analysis of linear stability of these black holes, what was done? I mean, I guess it was just linear stability under this given background, and then just to see that the spectra is describing the decay modes. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm not remembering the paper right off the top of my head, but I will find it after this and let you know. Because okay, I know that... A discussion.
But not all modes could be decaying because you have super radiance. So at least for the super radiance case, you if you have a spectra that has super radiance, then there are modes that are exponentially growing.
Right.
Or so then in principle they're not stable.
I suppose that's true. I think that's definitely a good question. It's something I haven't thought too much about yet, but definitely important, I think, to think about a little bit more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I was just wondering, so if these caps arise near the poles of your black holes, you know, so then like astrophysically, are there like, you know, other sort of like more mundane astrophysical processes, you know, perhaps that are like, you know, more important near the poles than the equators, you know? So for example, you know, could you imagine any kind of like MHD processes that are important for the formation of jets, maybe, you know, that might be more affected by these polar caps?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is something that we're thinking about a little bit. So I think that there is a theorist answer and there's a kind of more observational answer. So the observational answer, right, is that in addition, you have these caps near the black holes, there's also going to be, you know, an accretion disk and gas and plasma and all of this happening. And this is a small effect. So observationally, it might be a little bit challenging. However, I do think that jets is certainly something we're thinking about, how, you know, the formation of jets might be impacted by this and signatures from other types of kind of matter near the black hole in general. So you're definitely right that there are other astrophysical processes that could be impacted here. We just haven't looked at them yet.
Okay, got it. All right, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Seeing Rob has a question.
Thanks. So I had to come in, unfortunately, a few minutes late. I'm just wondering, in your slowly rotating solution, what's the behavior of the DCS scalar?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Can I go back to that? Yeah. So the DCS scalar.
Oh, there it is. Okay. I was trying to find it in your paper while you were there. I couldn't. Okay. So it also falls off. Like 1/r², and so it doesn't. Okay, all right. So you said in super radiance, you looked at not the DCS scalar, but a normal scalar. What if you look at the DCS scalar, what happens?
Right. So in principle, one could also consider super radiance of the DCS scalar. But the issue is that with the DCS scalar, because we have a shift symmetry in the theory, we mostly consider it to be massless, or the mass is very highly Planck suppressed. And so the super radiance, right, the frequency is proportional to mu m to the eighth. And so for a massless or very, very suppressed field, it's going to be a very small effect. So in principle, one could consider it, and I think you would get similar types of effects, but I think they would be subdominant to the additional scalar that we consider.
Okay, and thank you. And since you've got it on the screen, in this approximation, it wasn't a bit, you say it's slowly rotating, but you've also got DSK, which I understood to be the exact Kerr metric. Is that right, or is that just slowly rotating Kerr?
So this is exact Kerr. So the way that this approximation is done is that it is an expansion in both this zeta and chi. So really, zeta here is the key expansion parameter. And then this whole thing is just only valid for small chi. But yeah.
So it's exact Kerr with the rotation a little bit altered, sort of. Is that right? Right?
Yeah.
Okay. You can think about that. Okay, I see. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Maybe I can just ask another one, kind of following up on what Neil was asking about observational effects you might go after. So you mentioned like supermassive black holes in the HT a couple times. But so if I understand it correctly, this theory basically introduces some corrections to black holes at a certain length scale and below, right? So in that sense, would you expect any effect to be much, much larger on like stellar mass black holes as compared to supermassive black holes?
That's a good question. Yes. So I think with the approximations that we have here, we would expect that the effects would be stronger for like stellar mass black holes, but I think one could also potentially envision, seeing effects for supermassive black holes as well.
Okay,
thanks.
Okay, I guess I can ask one last question, following Neil's question. So for rotating black hole, we know, right, so there is this super radiant instability, but you also may have this so-called ergosphere instability, because you could have fields with negative energy existing in the ergosphere. So now that you have this cap, polar cap in for dynamic transiton black holes, so can you imagine having like similar, I don't know, polar cap instability in this case, right? So, or I don't know, because the fields may have negative energy in the polar cap. Is it possible?
Like caps from the ergosphere?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the cap playing a similar role as ergosphere. Can you have fields with negative energy in this polar cap? I see you're violating some energy conditions in the polar cap, is that right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, I mean, I guess the way that I think about this is that you just have a some kind of unique equation of state of the, you know, energy conditions in the field, in the cap regions. So if you had some behavior, some sort of negative energy field in the ergosphere or interacting with the ergosphere that would give you a similar effect, then I think you would get a similar type of cap effect.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking whether negative energy fields is allowed in this polar cap, or have you checked that?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't looked specifically, I guess specifically at what is necessarily allowed or not, beyond kind of saying that these regions exist, and here are some potential avenues for impacts they might have. But that would definitely be important to look into as well.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And thank you, Nia, and I guess thank you everyone for attending this last Strong Gravity seminar before the holiday. Yeah.
So are we hanging around a little bit more if there are some further questions informal or not? Is Liga
sure. going yeah,
and yeah. Another issue.
Yeah. We already stopped recording, right?
So Leah, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Can I ask you a tongue-in-cheek question?
Sure.
I'm sure a lot of people are laughing, thinking they know already what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask, and you're probably right. So I'm someone who is kind of cantankerous. So I've usually been asking people working in any particular, and it doesn't matter which, any particular extension to GR or alternative to GR, to give me the reasons why that theory as opposed to any of the many, many others that are out there. Mm-hmm. So I have done the same with dynamic chain assignments, even to Stefan or to Nick, Nico. So I'm asking you to hit me with your best shot.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's definitely a very reasonable question. I think what is really elegant about Chern Simons is that, right, we have this Chern Simons term, this kind of axion coupling to the metric or to the Pontryagin, theta RR dual, that appears in so many different areas from so many different places. So it appears from Green-Schwarz and string theory, this EFT of inflation, you know, it looks like an axion. So I think in terms of well-motivated theories, I think Chern Simons is a reasonable one to consider because it clearly, you know, we're not just like adding in this term ad hoc out of nowhere. It is well-motivated, I think. From those types of perspectives. And I think the fact that it has an axion is very attractive, even though, you know, it has this massless thing. I think that's a nice addition. And I think, yeah, I think it's well motivated from not just one area of physics.
Okay. So then going to your caps, I mean, would you, so any extension to GR will add some extra stuff to the right hand side, say, of RAB? And so presumably, I would say any most extensions of GR will have a stuff to the right-hand side
right.
that will violate the null energy condition. So the presence of caps would be generic from that point of view. So have you guys thought as to what might be the smoking gun characteristics you would go if for some reason, for whatever effect, you would attribute it to the presence of these caps? How can at the end of the day say, oh, it's pointing to dynamic assignments as opposed to any other option. Because as I said, presumably I expect that any other option will also have caps for the reasons I mentioned. We cannot guarantee the sign of that thing.
Yeah, no, that's a good question as well. I think you're right that we don't know for sure. So any theory which has a modification to the Einstein equation is gonna have the potential for this type of behavior. And I think with DCS, we know kind of the profile of the caps. So if we were to think about, for example, I was talking to Kent Yagi recently at Virginia about if this same type of effect would be present for scalar Gauss-Bonnet gravity. And so for scalar Gauss-Bonnet, there is a solution which is for Schwarzschild. An extension to Schwarzschild, you don't have to go to rotation, so you could potentially have a similar effect. Mm-hmm. But given that we haven't actually calculated them, there is also a chance that the contributions from those theories are not going to have this negative behavior. So we don't know for sure either way. But I think I would imagine that the profile would be different, and I would imagine that. If one were to, the strength of the effects would be different. So if one were to calculate, for example, something with, you know, jets, I'm, you know, not an expert on MHD or anything like that. But if one were to calculate some sort of correction, I would anticipate that the correction due to DCS would be slightly different from the correction due to, you know, scalar Yospinay or some other theory. But I think one would have to calculate those specifically to really think about that.
So the scalar Yospinay, you do actually like violate the area theorem, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can start with like a Schwarzschild black hole and then no scalar field, and it'll want to grow a scalar field, depending on the parameter, basically at the expense of shrinking the black hole mass. But you're saying that you're not aware of like an effect like that in transcendence? Or like basically shrink the black holes area?
Yeah, I don't think that has been looked at in transcendence yet.
Sorry, I think I interrupted you, please.
No, that's fine. I'm good. Thank you. I'm waiting for Adam. Adam, I thought Adam was going to ask a question on the EFT side. So Adam.
Putting me on the spot here. I was actually interested, Luis, in your questions along with the EFT lines earlier. Because it looks like we have a dimension five operator and it's doing interesting things, but we're ignoring any of the other higher dimension guys that might be there. I mean, you can just sort of like check on these solutions that's a good approximation. And
yeah, so the key thing here is that, right, so there are in principle, right, all of these other higher dimensional operators, but we just consider a truncation of the series. And as long as we say that, so everything else is when we, you know, do this derivation, when you have the AFT, everything else is Planck suppressed, is suppressed by the Planck scale. So as long as that the scale of our theory, this mu or alpha, is of a certain range, then the phi RR dual is going to be dominant term in that EFT. So as long as those certain requirements are met, then we don't have to worry about all the rest of the terms.
Sorry, so all the other terms are Planck suppressed, but this guy is, there's only this one term is suppressed by this lower scale mu. Is that what you're saying?
Well, so we are able to kind of essentially, so mu is also, there's a 1 over m Planck, but we are able to not tune mu, but mu is highly, you know, unconstrained. And so as long as, you know, we can choose mu such that this is the dominant term, that's allowed.
You know, don't have to worry about quantum corrections generating a bunch of other.
At this level, for this kind of basic model that we're using, we don't.
It was nice talk. Say hi to Stefan for me.
Oh, thank you. I will.
Just going back to that, I was just thinking about the previous thing you were talking about. So is it not true that if you start with just a spinning black hole with no scalar field in transiendence, then it'll want to grow a scalar field? And so in some sense, will that not come at the expense of the black hole shrinking? I guess with a spinning black hole, you can get mass without the area decreasing. Do you know, like, so first of all, is that true? You start with the spinning black hole in turn times, no scalar field, it'll want to create a scalar field, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I think
shrinking the mass, or?
Well, I think in turn Simons, you're always going to have the scalar field along with it.
Because just say I start with initial condition, I mean, that's valid initial conditions, right, to not have the scalar field, is that true? And then it will, I mean, there'll be some dynamics that'll induce, right?
I suppose, yeah. That's an interesting question. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think one of the next thing that I actually, the next project that I actually want to do is explicitly do out the kind of area theorem, black hole mechanics calculation. So I don't have an explicit answer or intuitive feeling about that yet, but I will soon.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, and thanks for the nice talk and
sticking
around the chat.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah,
thank you, Leah.
Yeah, thank you all very much.
Well, hope your throat gets better.
Oh, thank you. I'm drinking lots of tea.
All right, thank you. Have to go. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.